His roots were humble.
I grew up here on a little lemon ranch. It's the poorest lemon ranch in California, I can assure you.
Richard, come with me, would he?
My dad sold it before they found oil on it.
His ambitions, huge.
Then it is time for new leadership for the United States of America.
Triumphant in victory.
I always underestimated Nixon, see? I was underestimating him.
Bitter in defeat.
You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
He changed the world.
In one stroke, the balance of power has shifted to our favor.
Lost a nation.
These kids are useless.
Go on, get him!
And paid the price of power.
Others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win. Unless you hate them, then you destroy yourself.
No, we can't keep a damn secret in this government. They're stealing papers right out of this office.
Now we can create our own intelligence unit right here inside the White House.
Yeah, we got the press this time.
We got the big bowl. We're back.
Do you really want this, Dick? Then I'll be there for you. And we are going to win this time. I can feel it.
Yes, there are divisions in this country.
That's because you created them.
No young man who a great hero is? Abraham Lincoln. He brought this country together.
I love that man. I love him.
Daddy, you're the most decent person I know.
They don't know the real you.
If there's anyone in this country who knows more than me, it's Hoover.
Why do you think Kissinger is taping all your calls for history?
There's a cancer on the presidency, and it's growing.
Do not tell a lie, Richard.
If I were to open my mouth, all the dominoes would fall.
People gotta know whether or not their president is a crook.
Well, I am not a crook.
We're just not going to buckle to these people.
Dead kids. How the hell do we ever give the Democrats a weapon like this? I mean, if Cambodia doesn't work, we'll bomb Hanoi if we have to. Yeah, and that's right. If necessary, I'll drop the big one.
Now, this is a sudden death, gentlemen. We're going to get them on the ground and stick in our spikes and twist and show them no mercy. Anyone who screws with us, his head comes off. You got that?
Aren't you forgetting who put you where you are?
The American people put me where I am.
Well, that can be changed in a heartbeat.
Sir, Congress is considering 4 articles of impeachment.
The charges are really very serious, sir. One, abuse of power.
Took me a long time to fall in love with you, Dick. And it doesn't make you happy. You want them to love you.
2, obstruction of justice.
They never will.
3, failure to cooperate with the Congress, sir.
How much more is it going to cost? When do the rest of us stop paying off your debts?
This is Nixon's finish.
He's completely lost touch with reality.
And last, bombing Cambodia, sir.
They can't impeach me for bombing Cambodia. The president can bomb anybody he likes.
Dick, sometimes I understand why they hate you.
Richard, strength in this life, happiness in the next.
Only if you've been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain.
Don't cry. The fight.
When they look at you, you see what they want to be. They look at me, see what they are.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. This week, we are tackling Nixon, Oliver Stone's epic biopic of the 37th President of the United States of America. Here with me is someone you've heard on the network before as a guest on Ryan Daly's Give Me Those Star Wars podcast, law enthusiast Omar. Omar, welcome to the Film and Water podcast.
Hey, Rob. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to have you here, and I'm always happy to poach some of Ryan's guests. I enjoyed your 2 guest spots on Give Me Those Star Wars. And I guess I should mention like how this sort of love match came together, and that a couple of episodes ago, I mentioned the movie Nixon, that I was a big fan of it, and I also mentioned that I didn't know anyone else that had seen this movie. And then right after that, Ryan got a hold of me and said, well, you know my friend Omar that was on those Star Wars episodes? I said, sure. And he says, Omar loves that movie too. You should get a hold of him. And I was so excited because I don't know anyone else that's seen this movie.
It was a very mutual feeling because you have to understand that, like, I don't go around meeting a lot of people who are, like, really keen to talk about this movie.
Right.
And so it's, you know, just kind of two lost, lonely souls wandering around found each other, and I'm grateful for the chance to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, an almost four-hour movie about Richard Nixon sounds like homework to a lot of people. And, in fact, there's a great quote I found today online about that Oliver Stone originally pitched this movie to Warner Brothers, who referred to it as 3 hours of men in dark rooms talking. And
that's the thing. It's not, I mean, technically speaking, that's not wholly inaccurate.
No, right? It's not.
From a superficial level, that's correct. So if I'm some big shot studio executive, you know, in 1994, 95, let alone now, of course, if I was interested in making money for shareholders, I wouldn't want to make a movie like that, but I would contend that, you know, after having seen it many, many, many times, you know, that it completely subverts that assessment of it. Maybe you and I are just the exceptions to the rule, and that's going to have to be the way it is. But I do contend that there is a whole lot more to that movie than meets the eye. And, you know, it's really a wonderful, wonderful, you know, character sketch, the kind that we're not really going to see ever again, given the way how the landscape and the economics of Hollywood right now. So, you know, I'm glad they made it, even though I'm pretty sure they lost a ton of money on it. It really is a movie that has resonated with me, you know, continually through the years.
Yeah, there's not a giant blue beam in sight in this movie. This is all adults. Before I get into asking you about how you came to this movie, I do want to give everybody a little bit of context. This movie has an amazing cast that Oliver Stone assembled. We've got Anthony Hopkins playing Richard Nixon, Joan Allen playing Pat Nixon, the late great Powers Booth as Alexander Haig, Ed Harris as E. Howard Hunt, one of the plumbers, Bob Hoskins as J. Edgar Hoover, the late, great E.G. Marshall as John Mitchell, David Paymer as Ron Ziegler, David Hyde Pierce as John Dean, Paul Sorvino as Henry Kissinger, Mary Steenburgen as Hannah Nixon, J.T. Walsh as John Ehrlichman, James Woods as H.R. Haldeman, Kevin Dunn as Charles Coulson, and many, many more. I mean, of course, hours. This thing is just unbelievably stocked.
It's unbelievable. I'm just thinking about, you know, even some of the other people that you didn't mention. And you didn't mention them only because there are way too many A-list, you know, actors in there. Like, Larry Hagman's in it. I'm pretty sure, wasn't Dan Hedaya in it?
Dan Hedaya, who played Nixon himself in a movie. Played. Yeah, Dan Hedaya. Edward Herman, Madeline
Edward
Kahn.
Herman, yep. Five-ish Fingal from the David E. Kelly shows. Like, a whole, just, I mean, this is, again, you know, it makes me nostalgic for an era where you could hire, you know, actors of this caliber in mass. You know, you probably couldn't do that now, but, like, not only you're getting, like, a bunch of first-rate actors, you're getting a bunch of first-rate actors, you know, at the peak of their powers. You know, you're getting mid-90s Joan Allen, which is when she was sort of at her most prolific. Anthony Hopkins was 3 or 4 years removed from Silence of the Lambs, and he had just done Remains of the Day. David Hyde Pierce had just won an Emmy for Frasier. Yeah, this cast, pound for pound, I do not think there was a better, more well-assembled, more star-heavy ensemble in that year that I remember seeing, or even in the preceding year or two. Just for sheer star power, like just A through Z, it's pretty astounding. If you don't mind, one thing I remembered, speaking of the casting of Anthony Hopkins, something that I thought was really fascinating was one of my buddies had gotten me about 15 or 16 years ago a biography of Oliver Stone, and I was reading through the part on Nixon. Do you know who was originally cast in the Nixon character role?
I know that he reached out to Jack Nicholson and Tom Hanks.
So, I had heard that too. They did not get as far as Mr. Warren Beatty. They had actually had an initial framework of a deal with Warren Beatty, And then they did a read-through, an elaborate read-through at Beatty's house. And, like, they were short, you know, and they had casted Beatty before they had casted everyone else. And so they just got together some actors that they mutually knew just to sort of sit in on these roles. They weren't thinking of hiring any of them. Now, in the middle, like, during the read-through at Beatty's house, it just became apparent that there were just some inconsistencies and a big gap between how Beatty was interpreting the role and what Stone was looking for. So at the time, it was sort of mutually agreed that they would go no further. But interestingly enough, as they were leaving, and it was on friendly terms, but as they were leaving, Beatty pulled Stone aside and he was like, well, I think we know who's going to play Pat. And it ended up being Joan Allen, who was not even initially considered for the role. She just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Hmm. I never heard that. I can't picture Warren Beatty in this part. Warren Beatty's just much too... A, handsome, and B, charming to play Nixon. That's just
these were two things, two qualities certainly not in abundance in the 37th president. That's for sure. Although you know Beatty is a decent enough actor to pull off a lot, but that might be too heavy a lift. You know, the other thing that comes to mind, because we were just talking about our mutual friend Ryan and the fact that I made him sit through this back in like 98 or 99. And, you know, besides being, you know, unimpressed by the movie itself, I think he also, it always festered in his craw that, like, Anthony Hopkins, like, neither looked nor sounded remotely like Nixon. And, you know, this became, like, a minor point of contention between me and him. Because I would agree, you know, like, Anthony Hopkins would not have been my first, would not have sprung to mind initially as like, ah, there's the person that's going to really capture the essence of him. But I mean, the performance is so good, and he captures so many of his thematic qualities and his broad mannerisms, the sweatiness, the paranoia, the endless capacity for self-pity. Like, it didn't even matter that, like, he didn't really look or sound very much like Richard Nixon. I mean, I remember when they did Frost Nixon about a decade and a half later, Frank Langella earned an Oscar nomination for playing the Richard Nixon part, and he was much more stereotypically had the mannerisms, the physical mannerisms of Nixon. But I thought Anthony Hopkins was wonderful, and I think his work was his work was noted with an Oscar nomination that year.
Yeah, I mean, over the course of the 3 hours and like 40 minutes this movie runs, I mean, the director's cut runs that long, and that's the one that I'm familiar with. Is sure. Yeah, he doesn't really do a Nixon impersonation, but he crafts a character. That is Nixon. And that is something Oliver Stone talked about because, of course, you know, Oliver Stone was coming off of JFK, which was notoriously very controversial. And when you heard that he was going to do a Nixon biopic, you know, the whole idea was, oh, my God, this is going to be a hatchet job. The Oliver Stone, noted, you know, bomb-throwing liberal is going to just tear Nixon a new one. And I don't think that that's what this movie does. I think this movie – I mean, look – this movie, I think, is enormously fair to Richard Nixon. It also paints a fairly negative view of Richard Nixon, but I think that's fair.
That's good. It's good that it does because, you know, I think, you know, when you take the whole panoply of his career and his public life, you're talking about, like, one of the most controversial and complicated figures of the post-war American era. You know, so yes, I think, you know, the way you're contextualizing it is very interesting. And it's something I wanted to note, too, because, you know, Oliver Stone was coming off of JFK and he was also coming off of right off of Natural Born Killers. And, you know, he was sort of at the zenith of his fame and influence at that time. And I think everyone who was paying attention to Hollywood at that time, you know, I was only like 14 when it came out. I'm not sure how old you were. So, like, I wasn't really, like, closely linked up to the machinations of Hollywood. But I even then, I knew enough to know that, like, oh, my God, the JFK guy is going to tackle Richard Nixon. This is going to be this most incendiary, potentially, you know, controversial movie ever. And so it was such a pleasant surprise. And, you know, even and in retrospect, an especially pleasant surprise that I think Stone was reasonably responsible and, you know, sort of narrowly tailored in the way he portrayed a very sprawling, complicated, controversial American life. I mean, his career began in controversy and it never ended. He took it with him to the grave. And, you know, the fact that Stone was so relatively even-handed about portraying him when we were all expecting something else is really a testament. And, you know, on that note, one of the things I wanted to say was, you know, Oliver Stone is not, he's someone that as the years have gone on, we've really, you know, become more inclined to associate him with controversy and you know, the controversial context of whatever movie he's promoting at any given time, right? So, like, he'll go down to Cuba and do some, like, you know, like, controversial interviews with Castro, or he'll, you know, be in Russia interviewing Putin, or he'll release, you know, a documentary, you know, a very subversive documentary about the history of the United States. And so much of Oliver Stone in the last, you know, 20 years has been more about the controversy surrounding him. But, like, this is a person who, like I said, even though he's not often cited for greatness, like, he did a run of movies from, you know, when he started, like, really, like, in Salvador in, like, the mid-80s through, I would say, Nixon, which I would argue is his last really great movie. Like, I would argue that 10-year stretch would put him alongside some of the greatest filmmakers in American history. You know, he's won 2 Academy Awards for directing, 3 Academy Awards total. That puts him in, like, very, very rarefied company with people like Spielberg and Clint Eastwood and John Ford and Milos Forman and Ang Lee, people who are really rightly revered as, like, masters of the craft. And he's not often, you know, we don't talk about him like that because he steps in it so much. But I think Nixon is really exhibit A for, you know, masterful, like expansive, operatic storytelling.
Yeah, that's interesting, your comment about that this was his last great movie. When you think of his films after this, which are U-Turn, Any Given Sunday, Alexander, World Trade Center, W, none of those are going to make, you know, any great lists of, you know, any
list
of great
films.
No, they're
not. Like, not at all. Like, I think there are moments in all of those movies, like, individual moments that are, like, sort of laudable and noteworthy. But then, you know, when you go back and you think, I mean, he won an Oscar in the late 70s for writing Midnight Express, and then he did, like, and from 86 onward, he did, just off the top of my head, I might be missing something, but he did Salvador, Platoon, you know, Wall Street, Talk Radio, Born on the 4th of July, The Doors, JFK, Heaven and Earth, Natural Born Killers, and Nixon. I mean,
that's
a
run,
hell of
yeah.
a filmography. It's like sprawling. It's sprawling in its ambition. It's sprawling in its scope. It's sprawling in like, its cast and, like, the various narratives. And so I think it's this movie should really be a first-rate example of what Stone is capable of when given a whole lot of money, left to his own devices, and, you know, really presented with a challenge of tackling an incredibly polarizing figure like Nixon. I think he hits it out of the park. You know, I wrote a little note to you before we started a couple days ago because I was rewatching it, and I was just like, there are so many things about this movie that shouldn't work, but do. You know, so many things on the surface that, like, really would not pass the smell test if I was evaluating how a filmmaker was going about it. A lot of potentially ham-handed moments of dialogue and, like, really, like, overtly, like, Shakespearean moments that I'm just like, all right, that's a little bit over the top. But he nails it. And, like, there are moments when you expect him to go big or, like, overly sentimental or manipulative, and, like, he pulls back. And, like, I think that's a testament to, you know, what you have him at this point is, like, a 50-year-old guy sort of at the peak of his powers, I would think, before he became, you know, maybe a little too self-aware.
Hmm. Yeah, I do think this is a brilliantly constructed movie. It was written by a team of writers, Stephen J. Revell and Christopher Wilkinson, and then Stone himself, who gets a writer's credit. And the movie opens at basically the end of the story. It opens with Nixon in his White House about to be impeached just before he resigns. And through a series of voiceovers done in sort of a newsreel style, we get caught up to speed for those of you that don't know the story. And we talk about, you know, hear all these things about Spiro Agnew, his vice president has had to resign, and Gerald Ford has replaced him, so we know what's coming. I mean, I think just the idea of presenting Nixon's political career, which spanned a good 20 years at the forefront of the American social and political scene, just the way this is presented to me is brilliant. Because, I mean, like, I want to ask you, when you saw this movie, how familiar were you with the history? Did you come into this movie knowing a lot about Nixon?
Yeah, I did. I mean, like I said, I was 14 when I saw it, but I was, like, a little weird. I was super into politics. Like, I mean, I knew what was going on. I was super into the news, and like also contextually, you have to remember, like, this came out in the fall of 95, so it was about a year after two momentous events in the Nixon history. One was the 20th anniversary of Watergate, and, you know, to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Watergate, like, you know, news organizations ran, like, expansive documentaries about what had happened, and, you know, like, I was sort of at an age where, you know, it was a really good way to, like, fulfill, like, a social studies projects and things like that, and so, you know, and because it was, you know, and I had read All the President's Men, and I had seen the movie, and the other thing that had happened in earlier was, like, this was about a year and a half after Nixon himself had died. He died, I think, in the spring of 94, and, of course, when that happened, that sort of set off a round of tributes and documentaries and re-examinations of everything, so I was coming into it just knowing, you know, a fair amount about politics and American political history myself, but also because given the time in which the movie came out and the context surrounding the release of the movie, I was sort of all like primed for, you know, to know about what had been going on. So like Watergate had been expansively examined, you know, the Nixon legacy had been expansively examined. You know, the thing I wanted to bring up, you know, because you just made me think about it. You were talking about, you're addressing sort of the scope of what they're covering, right? How the sort of beginning near the end of the story. And, you know, one of the things that, again, should not work about this movie for me, but does, is the constant cutting back and forth between, you know, the past and the present, particularly with respect to growing up in Whittier. And, like, second of all, the fact that, like, the first hour and 15 minutes, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure the first hour and 15 minutes of the movie runs like a separate period. It goes from like him running in 1960 to and losing, and then all the way to 68 when he decides to run for president again and wins the election. And so it's one of the things this movie should not succeed at, but does, is there's a huge breadth and scope of the man and his legacy that you could potentially tackle, right? Like, again, I contend probably the most fascinating figure of the American post-war era, certainly the most interesting political leader of the post-war era, just because he did so damn much and he was like always around for everything. But like, because of his history, like, you could conceivably have done just a movie on his pre-presidency, like from when he ran like a contentious Senate campaign and was Ike's vice president, almost got kicked off the ticket, which they talk about in the movie, all the way through like the closest election in American history in 1960. That alone could have been a movie. You could have done a movie about the period between 1962 and 68, when he ran for governor of California, loses humiliatingly, tells the press that, like, that's it, guys, you won't have me to kick around anymore, I'm done with politics, like, F you, and, like, his obituary is written. In fact, I think there's a part in the movie where, like, the newsreel, they do, like, a fake little newsreel, like, basically writing his political obituary, and the fact that he sort of rehabilitates himself and comes on, returns back to the scene, and, like, cashes in his IOUs with Republican candidates and improbably, like, gets the nomination and wins, like, a nail-biter of an election in the midst of, like, the Vietnam War and, like, race riots tearing apart America. I think, you know, in the context of, you know, like the divisive 60s and, like, the political assassinations of, like, of JFK and Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, and Bobby Kennedy, the fact that, like, Nixon, of all people, reemerged is itself the subject of a fascinating movie. You could do a fascinating movie on everything that happened from when he was sworn in to when he resigned, right? Like the Vietnam War, like rapprochement with China and the Soviet Union, like everything leading up to Watergate. And of course, that alone would be a great movie. You could also do a movie on the 20 years of his post-presidency when he walks out of the White House, tail between his legs, the most despised and unpopular figure in the country, and slowly rehabilitates himself and reemerges on the scene as, like, dare I say, a beloved elder statesman. Like, you could do that because, like, there's such a wide and expansive scope to his story, and, like, Oliver Stone and his screenwriters, who I think got an Oscar nomination for the script, like, could have easily lost the battle with a subject that sprawling. And that, you know what I mean? It would be really hard to tame that. And they somehow make it work. Now, I've only seen the director's cut that you're talking about a couple times. So, like, I don't have a huge memory of it. I'm super familiar with the theatrical version. But, like, man, they shoehorn a lot in there, but it never feels shoehorned. It always feels vital and important to the story.
Yeah, the director's cut has extended sequences with Sam Waterston, yet another actor. high caliber.
I forgot
playing Dick Helms, the head of the CIA, who in this movie is utterly terrifying. He is so scary because there's this great scene where Nixon goes to visit him, and when he first meets him, he says he calls him Dick, and Nixon says, "You know, most people call me Mr. President," and he goes, "Well, so shall I." And then literally the next line he says to him, he's like, "Well, Dick," and he call, you know, you're like, "Wow, he is so not afraid of Richard Nixon." And I mean, this, like I said, this thing is, it's. I want to try and keep my thoughts coherent, but it's hard because this movie does, as you just said, has covers so much ground, and stylistically, it really does toggle back and forth between. You mentioned like some very Shakespearean large moments. There's a scene where they're on a boat with him and Kissinger and Haldeman and Ehrlichman and
Ron Ziegler,
and they're talking about the Vietnam War, and Nixon says something to the effect of, "Well, you know, if North Vietnam won't capitulate, I'll drop the big one." And there's this, you know, bass note, you know, which, by the way, the music in this movie is by John Williams, Mr. Star Wars, Jaws himself, John, who does a tremendous job. The score in this movie is fantastic.
It never gets in the way, but it has a way of like adding to the creepening, like sort of feeling of like paranoia, and also it sort of highlights the sort of Shakespearean tragedy of his story, and like that's what I like about it. I love the score; it's like very memorable.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I never knew who did the music until I looked it up today, and I went, "Wow, it's John Williams! I know that name."
Yeah,
but I mean,
I would also put in we were talking about toggling back and forth. You know, the editing is marvelous, and the editing is right out of JFK. It looked a lot like JFK, like the cutting to the black and the white. And then I noted that, like, the editor was Robert Richardson, who won an Oscar for JFK. And I think JFK is, like, one of the – probably a masterclass in, like, film editing. And, like, so it's not surprising that this follows the formula. It's done, like, so well. And, like, that scene on the boat, it's, like, perfect. Like, he's surrounded by, you know, these guys. And then, like, what I noted, you know, I like that you noted, like, the sound effects when he talked about – dropping the big one. I love the reaction from his staff when he said that. Like, even Kissinger is like, "What the hell are you? What are you saying? What's happening right now?"
Right, and he said that scene is where he's cutting into his steak, and right after he mentions dropping the big one, we get a big close up of the steak, and the steak is bleeding way more than any steak really would. And he actually yells to his manservant Manolo. He's like, "Take this away from me." And so you have a scene like that, which is big and theatrical and kind of unrealistic. But then conversely, you have all these scenes with James Woods and J.T. Walsh as Haldeman and Ehrlichman, those guys are like almost documentary level realistic. I mean,
those two guys
are amazing. I mean,
they really are.
It's unfortunate that James Woods is slowly turning into the guy that he played in real life. But I mean, they are this sort of horrible version of like those theater masks, like the smiling and the frowning. Because in this movie, they really and it's probably a little unfair, but in this movie, they present Haldeman, played by James Woods, as snarling and evil. Absolute unrepentant anti-Semite. He refers to Kissinger as Jew Boy Henry all the time,
and then he refers to it as Jew York City. I'm pretty
Jew
sure.
Jew York City, as at one point. And then J.T. Walsh's John Ehrlichman. They kind of go soft on Ehrlichman. Ehrlichman in this movie is much more kind of like, "Come on, everybody, let's pull back a little." And apparently, in real life, that wasn't the case. Ehrlichman was apparently just as bad as Holden.
No, yeah. I think what it was that, like, just on a superficial physical level, like, Haldeman just looked like a schoolyard bully, and he looked like a goon and enforcer. I mean, that's the funny thing. It's like the presidential staff up to then, and really since then, it's been infused with a sense of majesty, you know? It really is like all the king's men kind of thing, with, like, you know, like the Arthur Schlesingers and like the John Kenneth Galbraiths and all the windswept, handsome New Englanders who surrounded Jack Kennedy, right? And, like, you know, the Camelot and the Next Frontier. And, like, Haldeman was just a fixer. He was a goon. And what I like about Woods and Walsh's interplay was just, to me, they were just kind of like the real talk Greek chorus. You know, just kind of translating everything for us. I mean, just there's some great exchanges between them. Like, I can't remember the specific context, but, like, you know, like the dynamic is that, like, Nixon will absorb some, you know, some crazy news, or he'll issue some ridiculous order, and they'll just stare back at him impassively, or they'll, you know, sort of encourage his thinking. But then when they're amongst themselves, like, you know, like Woods will turn to Walsh, and say, Haldeman turning to Ehrlichman, and he'll just be like, yeah, this guy's going to basically blow up all of Southeast Asia because he's pissed he went to Whittier instead of Yale.
Right, you know what I mean? Yeah.
And it captures the nail on the head. And, like, as everything is falling apart, the other thing I noticed the other day when I was watching, I loved when, like, the vise was tightening and, like, you know, rats were jumping ship. Like, when they're out of the Oval Office and they're, like, strategizing after talking to the president, and, like, Haldeman turns to Ehrlichman and he's like, by the way, John, you know we're next, right? Just that so scene, matter of fact, it was great.
That scene, that long walk and talk through the white, through the Oval Office, is masterful, because I love how they weave in and out of other staffers, which, and other staffers can't hear that conversation, so they have this very serious conversation, and then they have to get quiet because the other, and then, like, we see, like, a White House tour go by, and they have to go by, and and then that's it. You mentioned the ending where it ends with, where you see Haldeman say to Ehrlichman, because the noose is tightening on everybody, and he says, you do know we're next, right? And you're like, oh man, like, they know that they're about to go to jail for this guy. And
it's
probably my favorite scene in the movie, because it's just those two guys are just so simpatico, and you're kind of just like, why are you sticking with, is the idea of being that close to power so entrancing that you're willing to go to prison to stay there?
I mean, without making this digression into, you know, current events, and without knowing anything about your ideology, I think we're seeing an extended example of that in real life now, right?
It's a really good
question. I do think they were loyal to him to an exceptional degree, but I also think, you know, never underestimate how much they also despise the Eastern establishment and the Democratic politicians. It's a really great question as to why. I don't know. And you know, it's funny that they didn't have the same, and I think this contrast is portrayed really well by David Hyde Pierce. You could sort of sense with John Dean, on the other hand, his deepening awareness of sort of the crap storm he was in, and just, like, the sort of nervous, like, darty, like, eyes darting back and forth, yet still wanting to project, you know, a sense of calm and assurance and loyalty to the president. And then just, I love when Nixon's like, you look tired, John. Why don't you take that beautiful wife of yours up to Camp David? Why don't you just write a summary of everything that happened? And David Hyde Pierce is like, you want me to write everything about Watergate and put my signature on it? And Nixon's like, yeah. And it's like, so, again, you know, it's funny. We're talking about roles that are not huge, necessarily. Like J.T. Walsh and David Hyde Pierce are not in the movie for an exceptionally long period of time. That's the thing about these character actors or these other stars, like, filling in these supporting roles. It's like the sizes of the roles are not that significant, but the way they sort of make their impact and their impression on him is really sizable and significant. Like, you know, my favorite exchange, I mean, I think you pointed to a really good exchange between Haldeman and Ehrlichman. My favorite exchange, and I, again, this is, I'm sure this is fictional, I have no idea if this is true, but like it's between Hunt and Dean.
Oh man, that's a great scene.
Oh yeah, outside, you know, when Dean is, like, you know, like, talking to him and, like, metaphorically or literally making the payoff. And, like, Dean is just like, how the hell do you have the temerity to blackmail the president of the United States? And Harris is just like, that's not the question you should be asking. And the question you should be asking is, why is he willing to pay? And you know, and I think he punctuates that conversation with, you know, just a great line. He says, you know, here's the thing you need to know about Richard Nixon. He's the darkness reaching for the darkness. I love that line. I don't even know what it means entirely, but, like, it really sort of captures the feel of that movie, and, like, what a blessing it is to have such terrific. I mean, how long is Ed Harris in that movie cumulatively? What do you think?
Yeah, I think he's
6 minutes.
I think he's got. He opens the movie, because they said the movie opens with the Watergate break-in. But he's probably in the movie probably 5-6 minutes total.
Yeah, but he makes such an impression. Now, I know it's convenient that he kind of resembled you know, a younger G. Gordon Liddy and David Hyde Pierce resembles John Dean, but like they're such
Howard
good
Hunt.
Actors.
He's Howard Hunt.
Oh, sorry, Howard, not Gordon Liddy. Howard Hunt.
Yeah.
And David Hyde Pierce resembles young John Dean, but like they do such a great job with such a great script that they leave this impression. I mean, really, only Anthony Hopkins, Joan Allen, maybe Paul Sorvino have roles of any notable length. Like, if you boil down Mary Steenburgen's, you know, time, screen time in, like, a three-hour movie, again, maybe, like, 8 to 10 minutes at most. I'm stretching there. I don't know if that's true. But, like, she makes her impression felt. Her ghost, her influence hovers over him every step of the way. And, like, a lesser script in the hands of lesser actors would get lost in the fog of, like, that three-hour script.
All the scenes with Nixon's parents, said you played Mary Steenburgen as Hannah Nixon, and this other guy, Tom Bauer, as his father.
Yeah. Yeah.
They present, and his brother, his older brother is Tony Goldwyn, who died.
Who's going to be in Scandal, yeah.
Dies of, he's in Scandal now. Dies of tuberculosis.
Yep.
They really present these scenes where it's funny because Nixon, as a character, romanticizes that time. He refers to his mother as a saint. But to me, the scenes, the way they present those moments, to me, they're horrific, because the mother, Hannah Nixon, while she clearly loves her children, it's this sort of weirdly loving but also cruel, you know, like a conditional kind of love. And there's this scene later on where we see Mary Steenburgen much older. As Nixon is ready to be president, or maybe has just become president.
He's about to run at 67.
He's about to run, yeah. And we hear an off-screen interviewer played by Oliver Stone interview Hannah Nixon. And apparently these questions and answers are real, where someone asks her, are you proud of your son? And she says, I have always been proud of all my children. And it's like, what an evasive answer to give. But we're talking about your son that's going to be the president, and yet she can't answer that.
I agree with that sentiment. I actually think that sentiment applies just as much, if not more so, to the previous question, which is, do you think he can be a great president? And she was like, if he's on God's side, you know, he could be. I don't. But like, it was still kind of noncommittal. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, just say yes, dude. But you're right in a sense that there's sort of a coldness and cruelty. But at the same time, I would argue that in her piety and in her, I mean, I think she clearly favors him over the other kids because she sees something in him. She sees sort of like the stubborn, you know, like the war between a stubborn adherence to like the Quaker values and, you know, and a striving for something else. And she also probably, because she's weird, she probably also sees in him some kind of chosen divine strength, because he was someone who didn't die of tuberculosis. So I do think she probably was more, I don't want to use the word doting, because that implies, you know, sort of like affection, but she probably paid more attention to him than the other kids. It was a weird dynamic, but at the same time, like, it's an influence that, like, he never shakes. Like, he never shakes. And, like, again, limited screen time, a hell of an actress, a hell of a script, and, like, she, like, her presence really reverberates through the movie, and, like, you cannot ask for more than that. And, like, like, that movie does so much in terms of laying the seeds of Nixon's, you know, like, core elements and characteristics, but especially in including his class consciousness. And the fact that he was so bitter and aware, constantly aware of, like, where he came from. And, you know, other presidents grew up poor, you know, like Ronald Reagan grew up the son of an alcoholic in Dixon, Illinois. Jimmy Carter grew up on a peanut farm. You know, Harry Truman, like, but Nixon, like, it burned in him. You know what I mean? Like, it always stayed in him. And I think through Hopkins' performance and, like, the way they contextualized it growing up, he never was able to shake it. Never. Not once. During his initial run for the presidency and in the years of wilderness in between. And, like, when he finally gets and scales the summit and is elected to the most powerful position in the Western world, in the entire world, like, he can't let it go. He's always thinking about, like, the Kennedys and, like, what they did to him and, like, their lives of privilege. Like, I'll never forget, like, when JFK is assassinated and, like, he's sitting in his New York attorney's office and he's, like, looking at these videos of the handsome, windswept Kennedy family playing touch football on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, and like he's just sitting there ruminating on like how much they hated him and like how everything was handed to them. You know what I mean? I just think those brief flashes and glimpses into his childhood did such an effective job at painting a portrait of the kind of person and president he would end up being.
Yeah, there's a line in that later on in the scene where he mentions that the last thing Robert Kennedy ever said to him was he called him a two-bit grocery clerk. And
yeah.
And the way Hopkins read that line, like he's spitting it out through his teeth. Like he is just so absolutely bitter at being, you know, where he's from. And, you know, it's like, you know, you just want to say, get over it, dude. Just get over it. And except part of it is, again, like the scene, the father. I want to make sure I mention this because this is a very powerful moment where we only get one scene with the father. And he is a butcher. And there's this whole scene where they have dinner together and he says grace and he's wearing his blood-streaked smock.
And
the mother says, could you take that off, Frank? And he says, this is how I pay the bills. I'm not ashamed of it. And he does this whole bit about, you know, happiness isn't what life's about. It's struggle. You have to keep struggling. And he says, you know, because you're not going to get anywhere on your looks. And he's like, the minute you stop struggling, they've beaten you. And you're like, well, no wonder Nixon grew up screwed up with that kind of bizarro. The way they present the father, it's almost like the father wants to be struggling for its own sake.
You know,
like he's almost taking pride in the fact that he's downtrodden because God forbid you should relax and have fun for a moment. When they say grace, he does this whole bit about, he says, I'm going to say grace. And he uses that moment to castigate the older son, Tony Goldwyn, for asking for a new suit to take his girl to the dance. And all the little kids are like confused. And the one little kid says, are we going to say grace now, daddy? And all the kids chuckle. And he's like, you think this is funny? And you're like, my God, how else are you going to turn out when your father is this miserable, bitter little monster?
Like you can draw a straight. Yes. I think that's logically, that is absolutely true. You can draw a straight line between that and the way he was. It is still, you know, I guess the only pushback I would give to that, although I think you're absolutely right, I think the only pushback I would give to that and the movie offers is that, like, you know, when Pat describes the way he was when they met and you sort of see the brief glimpses of their courtship and, you know, the way he still sometimes looked at her before things went sour in the White House, I'm just kind of like, hey, you know, you're in a spot where you actually could be happy. Like, you want for nothing, and you feel love. You know what I mean? And, like, that's the thing. And like, you should, at least he should ostensibly feel love. And, like, he just never did. And, like, he had this person, you know, he had this life partner who, you know, and I think, listen, I'm sure they took some dramatic liberties. I don't think, you know, it's funny. The dramatic liberties they took, based on what I understand of Nixon, is I don't believe that Pat Nixon was ever as disenchanted with him. I mean, I think she was disenchanted with the political life, and she made no bones about the fact that, like, it was not what she would have chosen. But, like, they were extremely close. And, like, the tragedy of the portrayal of him in the movie, and to some extent his degree of him in real life, is that, like, he could never stop and, like, enjoy. Like, it wasn't enough that, like, when he left Whittier and got to go to, like, freaking, like, Duke Law School or got, like, elected to Congress or, like, married this woman he had been assiduously courting for like a year, you know, like it wasn't enough. There always had to be more. It wasn't enough that he was like tapped to be like the youngest vice president in the nation's history by a revered war general. You know, it wasn't enough that he himself like capped off the greatest political comeback of the 20th century when he won in 1968. Like that's a fatal flaw. And I think the movie exposes that so well without ever going over the top. Like, there are so many moments where it could hit you over the head with this message, with basically a flashing sign, the way it did in Natural Born Killers, you know, look what we're doing. Yeah, like, seriously. But, like, for some reason, either the moments where they try to hit you over the head, they don't do it big enough, or Oliver Stone kind of steps back, and he just sort of doesn't get in the way of the story. So you're right. I think, you know, your analysis of him is correct. I would say that, like, the relationship between him and his wife is fascinating, and I think it's the one avenue, the one lifeline he could have to a normal life. Because he is who he is, he can't take it. but he won't grab onto that lifeline. That said, you know, like, she's fascinating. I think Joan Allen's characterization is fascinating, and I think Joan Allen took a potentially thankless role, you know, essentially what could be window dressing, and really infused it with humanity, loss, you know, loneliness, longing for a life that, like, could have been, and just kind of seemingly reserved. And I think, you know, the dynamic between them, they had tons of chemistry, and the dynamic between them was, like, very undeniable.
Yeah, they are a plausible couple.
Absolutely.
Anthony Hopkins and Joan Allen are a plausible couple. And, in fact, their relationship and his love for Pat, in fact, he drove her around on other dates.
Oh,
he
God.
Was so determined to keep tabs on her, which you could argue.
Oh, he loved her.
Like, yeah,
he,
I mean, on the one hand,
he loved her. Their entire marriage, he loved her. You know, I don't know if you ever got a chance to see this. Like, they go on YouTube when you have a spare moment and, like check, like, search for, like, Richard Nixon at his wife's funeral, because his wife died about a year before he himself died. And, like, they have newsreel footage of, like, him at her funeral in, like, the early 90s. And, like, he is sobbing uncontrollably. He is, like, shaking and sobbing. It's, like, very disconcerting. I remember, like, the other presidents were there, like Reagan and, like George Bush Sr., and they were just like, oh, wow, okay, is he okay? Seriously, this is really untoward. This is extremely awkward. Like, I don't think, you know, and I know far too much about presidential history, especially recent presidential history, than I should. And I can confidently say that, like, maybe Ronald and Nancy Reagan aside, I don't think there was a White House couple that was, like, as fanatically devoted to each other as, like, Pat and Richard Nixon. I mean, I think there was a funny moment in the film when he was down in, was it Dallas, when he was visiting with Larry Hagman's mysterious oil cartel, and they had hired, like, a young ingenue played by...
I was just about to mention that scene. Yeah, that's a terrific moment.
Yes, a young ingenue played by the future Bridget Wilson Sampras, who was clearly trying to, like, seduce him and was clearly, like, solicited by this group to get him to loosen up. And this is a technique that would work on, like, 90% of all other American politicians. She's beautiful. She's young. She's charming. And, like, he keeps, like, having to swat her away, and he keeps trying to show her pictures of, like, his kids and, like, talking about him. It's like oddly endearing for, like, such a monster.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly knows that she's trying to seduce him. It's not that he's oblivious, because they talk about jazz music at one point, and she says, well, it all depends on what I'm doing to the music. And then one of Nixon's flunkies comes over, Dan Hedaya, and says, hey, you know, Dick, there's more privacy in the back there. And Nixon takes this pause and he goes, no, Tooney, we're fine here. And so in that moment, it's very sweet. You're like, well, okay, Nixon could clearly cheat on Pat if he wanted to. And he's not. He's not remotely interested. And that's a great moment. I mean, that's the kind of thing where if Oliver Stone was just out to do a hatchet job on Nixon, he wouldn't have a scene like that. He wouldn't present a scene like that. He wouldn't make Nixon at all, somebody that you would admire. I think that's
could potentially a very cheap thing that could be shoehorned in by, like, a filmmaker who wanted to sort of make a splash. And I'll tell you what, like, the caricature of Oliver Stone from back then, or even the Oliver Stone from now, probably would be way more tempted to do something like that.
I think so. But
it didn't, and I think it was, like, all the better for it. I think that, you know, and the other thing is, you know, when we circle back to talking about Nixon's, you know, like, his portrayal of Nixon, you know, one thing the movie doesn't pull any punches with, and I think this is borne out in real life, is that, like, say what you will about his demons, and there's no doubt that his demons were the thing that undid him, but the tragedy of him and the Shakespearean tragedy of him that is so encapsulated so well in the narrative of the movie is that, like, this is not some, like, dilettante on the national and world stage. This is someone who has clearly, like, listen, agree with him or disagree with him. This is someone who has, like, very clearly defined, like, pragmatic and ideological leanings with respect to domestic and foreign policy. Right? Like, so he's super cynical in the way he goes about persuading people, and, like, that's fine. And we, you know, like, I think the parts in the movie where they so sort of obliquely reference the Southern strategy that Nixon and the GOP became famous for in the late 60s, calling out the war protesters as bums or, like, keeping his Vietnam peace plan like secret for so long. Like, that's clearly part of his brain that is very Machiavellian. But like, he's also highly intelligent about world affairs, like extremely pragmatic about, you know, about like diplomacy. And you know, again, if Oliver Stone was wanting to do a hatchet job, like, he could very easily have just portrayed him as like sitting in a smoke-filled room, not really caring at all about the details and nuances of policy. And to his credit, he gives Nixon like a lot of credit for how well he reads foreign leaders, be it Mao or Brezhnev, or and you know, like he takes him through even the political machinations of like and legal consequences of every step that's taken with regard to the Watergate investigation. He doesn't portray him as an aloof, you know, either dunderhead, which he clearly wasn't, or an aloof sort of Machiavellian person who was always scheming. No, he was someone who was constantly thinking about policy. Yeah, a lot of times to his own advantage. But like, I think Stone goes out of his way to treat Nixon as a pragmatist in a lot of ways, particularly with respect to foreign policy. Now, and he also, by the same token, goes out of his way to portray him as like deeply paranoid, deeply embittered, like constantly like suspicious of the motives of people around him, constantly thinking about the worst possible outcomes. And like, in a vacuum, I would be like, wow, that's pretty heavy-handed. But like, if someone knows even a modicum of the Nixon narrative, like, that's absolutely the way he was. I mean, he was like a walking contradiction. He was someone who could very pragmatically talk about like the need for universal health care, which, by the way, the movie deals with in the convention speech. He talks about like the need for like access to all health care, which was not sort of the conservative boogeyman that it is now. But at the same time, it shows him constantly thinking about how to gain an upper hand on his political adversaries, how to get off scot-free, and you know, maybe leave his own associates exposed, because he was a complicated person. And so I think that I give the filmmaker a lot of credit for the way he sort of deftly handles someone who, you know, he's almost a no-win situation, Nixon, because I don't think there's another American politician on the main stage in the last like 60 or 70 years that is so multifaceted, you know? Like, there are a lot of people who might just wear a black hat or, you know, whatever. You know, a lot of times people hew close to the caricatures, right? Like, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush were, you know, sort of delegators who were maybe not the most, I don't know, like, you know what I mean, not like super involved in the formulation of policy. Like, you know, like, maybe Jimmy Carter was like way too self-righteous, and you know, Trump is Trump. But like, Nixon was everything. Like, Nixon was coolly pragmatic, and Nixon was highly paranoid. Nixon was prone to bouts of rage and like had an endless capacity for self-pity. But he was also someone who, you know, knew how to organize, knew how to deal with staff, knew how to play them against each other, at times highly unemotional, fanatically devoted to his family. So, like, yeah, he's a really hard person to pigeonhole, and that's traditionally a really hard person to make a movie out of, and for some reason they pull it off.
Yeah, there's a number of scenes in this movie where the people around him, whether it's Ehrlichman or Haldeman or Ziegler or John Mitchell, they want to kind of do the politically expedient thing because it'll feel good.
Yeah.
They talk about, like, one point they want to fire Henry Kissinger.
Yeah.
Because they find out that he's the leaker to the New York Times. And there's this great moment where Nixon just sits in his chair for, like, a good beat and thinks. He just thinks. And the movie is – the movie's quiet, and it just rests its fate – it rests its camera on Nixon, and he goes, no. That's no, that would, and he realizes that politically that would be a mistake to do, even though it would feel good because none of them liked Kissinger. And that, yeah, you're talking about in those moments, it shows that Nixon was a deep thinker. And, you know, he was a very smart man, and he was able to see what was best for himself and maybe for the country in individual moments, and he wasn't swayed by emotion. And then conversely, there's another scene later on where after the leaks are getting worse and worse and worse, he has this meeting with, like, basically all of his cabinet, where he's terrifying because he starts talking about, as of today, all the leaks are over. And he's
and he
says something to the effect of like, and excuse my language, but he's like, if anyone here is caught leaking, their fucking head's coming off. And you're like, how terrifying would that be to hear the president of the United States talk like that? Because he sounds like he's ready to stab somebody. And you're right. This movie is able to present all of those contradictions. And there's another scene I specifically want to mention, because it's my favorite scene that features Nixon, where the movie is able to flip the script and make him the hero. Now, you mentioned Larry Hagman.
Yeah.
In this movie. Larry Hagman, he's one of the few people in the movie not playing a real person. He's playing a composite of these sort of fat cat oil businessmen that funded Nixon's presidential runs. And Hagman only has two scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
For the first one, is kind of a controversial scene because it seems to suggest that Nixon knew that Kennedy was going to be assassinated, because they talk about, you're going to run in 64 and we can bring you Texas. And Nixon,
that was real, by the way. Like, I don't know if you know this, like, Nixon was actually in Dallas the day before Kennedy came.
Right.
And
he says, you know, well, there's no, with Johnson on the ticket, there is no way there's no way Kennedy's going to lose Texas, and there's no way that Kennedy's going to drop Johnson. And one of the other goons says, what if Kennedy don't run?
Oh, in his Cuban accent, right?
Yeah, and Nixon just goes, that'll never happen, not in a million years. And the guy just stares at Nixon for a second, and there's this look that goes across Anthony Hopkins' face, like he kind of understands what's being said. And I've seen some critics say, oh my God, that's Oliver Stone suggesting that Nixon was in on it, and that's offensive. And I never took the scene that way. I took it as Nixon understood what was being said, but Nixon wasn't taking these guys seriously. Like, he was like,
that's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I think, again, you know, I would also say, you know, Oliver Stone could himself have saved, you know, some trouble by omitting a scene like that, like, because it's not necessarily germane or necessary, and it only serves to stoke probably baseless speculation about, you know, Nixon having even like a small hint of knowledge about something that potentially could happen. But like, it's not a scene that's like that's played to the hilt. It's not a scene that takes 15 minutes. And they don't belabor the point. And I didn't get that feeling at all. You're right. I just got the feeling that he knew that like a lot of people were unhappy with President Kennedy, particularly in Texas.
Yeah.
And I just kind of left it at that. And again, that's a move. That's another example of how the movie could have really gone off in a lot of different ways and become so insufferably heavy-handed and pushing a narrative and to fit an agenda. But that's the thing, you know. Like, I would just say, you know, Oliver Stone has been accused, sometimes not unfairly, of, you know, of trying to serve a particular political agenda. I remember a lot of people like Walter Cronkite, a lot of like very reputable people in the news industry and in the political industry were incensed when JFK came up, because like that was something that they felt was extremely heavy-handed and was made in the service of a particular agenda. And certainly a lot of Stone's documentaries, you could certainly say that about them, regardless of how you felt about the ideology. But the thing I always appreciate about Nixon is, like, what agenda is being served with a movie that is made like that about Richard Nixon? Like, because the only conclusion I come out of is that, like, whoa, what a complicated man. What a tragic story in a lot of ways. Huh, there's a lot to think about there. But, like, I don't think there's any agenda that's being served in the way that, like, Nixon is written and portrayed, or the way the people around him are written and portrayed. Like, I don't think there's, like, sort of a black hat villain. I mean, of course there are, but like, you know what I mean? Like, I think he comes off as far more interesting than that. And I don't think that like that movie really serves to further any kind of narrative that Stone wants to push, other than look at this extremely compelling individual and like his part in like the tapestry of like, you know, the latter half of the 20th century. And like, look at all that came of it. You know, like with JFK. JFK, by the way, is one of my all-time favorite movies. I think it's like technically an extremely well put together movie. I love its ambition. I love its breadth and depth and scope. It's probably my favorite Oliver Stone movie. I'm like the only person that thinks that like it should have won Best Picture that year instead of Silence of the Lambs. I love JFK. But like, I also think JFK, you could accuse JFK of trying to serve an agenda. I just think it's such a good movie that, like, it overcomes that very legitimate claim. But, like, Nixon, I don't think Nixon is made in furtherance of an agenda, do you?
No, not particularly. And except that your mentioning of a black hat makes me, again, to think of that scene with Larry Hagman, where there's a second scene where we come back.
Where they're pissed at him.
Where Nixon is now president, and he is now opening up to Red China, and he's working on detente, and Larry Hagman and these other guys are incensed with him because he has not turned out to be the rock-ribbed Republican that they want. And there's this moment where they basically say, "Don't forget who put you in the White House."
And he's like, "American people put me there."
Yeah. And Larry Hagman's character looks so offended, and he's like, he says, "Oh, really?" Well, he says, "Well, that can be changed." And this other guy with his big cigar goes in a heartbeat. And then Nixon has this great moment where he says, because Larry Hagman complains about the EPA, because he's an oil man. And he says, "Oh, the EPA's got their thumb up my ass and all this kind of stuff." And he mentions this horrible thing about that his grandkids are bussed into a town, so they have to go to school next to some black kids, except he doesn't use the word black.
No, he does not say black kids.
And he's the worst of the worst, because it's like he's this fat cat oil man who feels he has some ability to direct foreign policy, which is like, who the hell are you? But there's this great moment where Nixon says, basically, "Hey, look, Jack, if you want to go out and give your money to the other side, you want a pansy poet socialist to be president, go right ahead." And then he says,
"Right, because like you give your money to George Wallace,
crazy
George Wallace, you'll end up electing McGovern."
Yeah.
And that's right.
I'm sorry. He just has that line where he says, "And Jack, if you think the EPA is bad, try the IRS."
I forgot about that.
This look of terror comes across Larry Hagman's face.
Yeah.
And he says, he's like, "God damn it, Dick, you're not threatening me, are you?" And Nixon says, "Presidents don't threaten.
Yep.
They don't have to."
Yep.
And then as he walks out of the scene, Haldeman just gives this daggered look to Larry Hagman. And at that moment, you were totally rooting for Nixon.
Because a nice little trick, isn't it?
And I'm like, how am I rooting for H.R. Bob Haldeman? How am I possibly, in any perceived moment of reality, I am on Haldeman's side? Because that's how bad Larry Hagman's character is.
Well, that's how bad Larry Hagman's character was. And, you know, we can talk about Black Hat, but, like, the thing is, the reason I'm okay with that, even though Larry Hagman is... Right, he's a fictional character. Like, he's composite. There's no identifiable person. But, like, I think we probably both know enough about, like, political history to know that, like, those people exist.
Those people existed
in the past. And those big pocket, like, oil men from back in the day who, like, funded these campaigns, they were there. And, of course, they thought and still do believe that, like, their money bought some kind of outsized influence. And, like, the thing is, this is Stone being faithful to Nixon, because the historical record also shows that, like, you know, we think of Nixon as a conservative boogeyman in a lot of ways. We probably should. I mean, you know, with like the Southern strategy and like, you know, and Vietnam and everything. Yes, he in many ways he created a sort of modern, lasting conservative coalition that has reverberated through the decades. But I mean, you bring up the EPA, right? Like, He created the EPA.
Yep.
And I think what the movie does a really good job of showing is that, and this is a callback to an earlier scene, it is when Nixon's in private New York practice and he's at that delightful cocktail party with Madeleine Kahn and her all-too-brief appearances.
We haven't talked about her enough. She's so fun in this movie as Martha
really
Mitchell.
I mean, the real Martha Mitchell was crazy. I mean, I hate to say that because it's like we're caricaturing a woman with like serious, obvious mental health issues at a time when women were, you know, treated even worse than they are now, but also mental health was stigmatized the way, you know, to a degree it's not now. But, like, she is so delightful. And, again, what is her cumulative screen time in that movie? 2 minutes? 2.5 minutes?
Oh,
but
yeah. Like, so
like,
good.
E.G. Marshall is her husband as the future Attorney General Mitchell. He's obviously, like, so aware of how, like, what a powder keg of embarrassment his wife could be. And I love that scene where Nixon's like, "Why do you keep her around?" And he's like, "She's great in bed."
Yeah.
But you know, that scene at that party, it also like illustrates the chasm in that political party where Nixon stood, and that led to a situation where Larry Hagman's oil man at first courts him eagerly and then spurns him, you know, 8 years later or 6 years later, because Nixon sat right in the middle of like the harsh, hard right conservatism of like Barry Goldwater in 64, and like Ed Herman's character, Governor Rockefeller, who was like one of the liberal Republicans, who was conservative on like some economic issues only, but like on other, all other levels, like more liberal. And like Nixon split the difference, and like, but Nixon was also a pragmatist. And so like in many ways, he was non-ideological. You're talking about someone who created the EPA, who talked about universal health care, who declared a war on cancers, things that are would probably be anathema to members of both political parties now because they're considered politically toxic. And what's great about the Larry Hagman character and the conflict there, and then you say, how could he get us rooting for Nixon? It's because he was, Oliver Stone was disciplined enough to go where the facts led him. Nixon was actually sitting in the middle of a great divide. He was not nearly as conservative as like the weird John Birch right-wing crazy people wanted him to be, but he was more conservative than like, you know, than like the Ed Herman character, than like the Nelson Rockefellers and the Mitt Romney's dads, people like that. And like, but Nixon was a pragmatist. And so like it would have been very easy for Stone to like kind of give in to the liberal instinct of kind of portraying him as this conservative boogeyman and just like throwing the entire kitchen sink at him. And he didn't, because he was just like, what really happened? What was he really like? What were the forces like motivating him? And he allowed that to write itself. And like, that's why I think this movie sort of represents Stone firing in all cylinders. He's not being led around by an agenda. He's tackling a complex character and a complex subject and like leaning on history. So like, yeah, I mean, Larry Hagman's a fake. I mean, he's not a real person, but like, just like the Donald Sutherland character X in the JFK movie, who feeds, like, you know, the Kevin Costner character, like, his fever dream of conspiracy paranoia about the CIA and the FBI and their potential interests in wiping out President Kennedy. Like, there isn't a substantial grain of truth in where the Larry Hagman character is coming from and the roots of his conflict with Nixon. And I think Stone does a really good job just kind of, like, stepping back and letting that conflict play out. Whereas I think it's Oliver Stone of 15 years later, or the caricature of Oliver Stone that we heard about back in the mid-90s, would have meddled, would have put his thumb on the scales, and it would have been a far less potent and interesting dramatic experience.
Yeah, yeah. This movie really is about a guy. Like I said, this movie would not be fun if it was just an awful person that failed. But it's not. It's about a guy. I mean, the final speech that he has, as Nixon talks about, that, you know, it's only when you learn to get through the deepest valleys of life, only when you've been on the highest mountains. Yeah. And they really do present that this man had greatness in his grasp because he was so intelligent. But he was driven by his demons. The system ground him down, as it does. But, I mean, he gave into it, and that is really what the tragedy of all of this is.
And he gave into it for the reasons that you talked about a few minutes ago, because you can draw a straight line from that kitchen table conversation with his dad, and the lessons from his dad reverberated right to the White House briefing room or whatever, the kitchen room, whatever that room was where he gave his final speech, where the credits started to roll. That was his dad. It's like, that was Nixon in a nutshell, sort of the self-pitying way that, like, no one's ever going to, like, write a book about my father. He was what you'd call a little man. They knocked him down. No one's ever going to write a book about my mother. She was a saint. You know, she did this, she did that. No one's ever going to, like, remember them. And so there was this defiance, but there was also self-pity, talking about how, you know, always remember others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself. And then there's, like, the Nixon that, like, enigmatic, that, like, inexplicably drew people in. The Nixon that, like, despite going through this personal and professional hell, encouraging people, his staff and the young people of America, to like get involved in like public service, you know, to like stay active, to like stay the course. And who knows, it might have been pablum, but like I do think that like all the sides of Nixon were neatly encapsulated by that last speech, which, you know, is a word for word reconstruction of what his last speech, farewell remarks, were. And, you know, again, we can talk about the factual veracity of like him, you know, having to the circumstances in which he resigned, getting down on his knees and praying with Kissinger, or like, you know, when he's signing his resignation letter, just being like, I'm not going to give these guys the satisfaction. Pardon my language. I'm not going to give these guys the satisfaction of, you know, of an impeachment hearing. Fuck them, whatever. And just signing it. Who knows whether that happened? I'm sure there were dramatic liberties taken with that material and those scenes. I don't think it was that spiced up. That said, the circumstances, those scenes were so brief that, like, again, like, the circumstances were so tragic that, like, they were totally believable. And, like, what a great scene. Again, I know this didn't happen, but what a great scene near the end, right before the credits roll, when he's, like, staring up at, like, his nemesis, the photo of, like, President Kennedy lost in thought. And he says, when they look at you, they see what they want to be. When they look at me, they see what they are. I love that line. Love that line because it's 100,000% true. I love that line because it, like, demonstrates his instinct for self-pity. It demonstrates, but it also demonstrates what, like, an uncanny grasp he has on the way the world is. You know, we talked about how paranoid he is. We talked about how self-pitying he is, how he feels like, you know, the world's always screwing him over. But, like, he also kind of gets the way the world operates. And, like, as much as his dad's beliefs poisoned him, his dad's beliefs also instilled in him, like, a very clear-eyed view of the way the world works. Yes, Nixon would never be loved. Like, this is a man who, like was vice president for two terms, lost a nail-biter of an election in 1960 that he probably should have won if it wasn't for, like, some backroom tomfoolery in Texas and Chicago.
Right, we have to admit, probably stolen by the Kennedys.
Probably stolen by the Kennedys, and, you know, I have no problem admitting that. And then goes on to get elected and re-elected by the highest margin at the time known to man. Like, I think he only lost one state in 1972, mm-hmm. overwhelmingly popular. This goes back to Watergate. There was no reason for, like, you know, his underlings to, like, bug the Democratic National Committee. He was going to win. Just like there was no reason for him to look at that picture of President Kennedy and, like, wail in self-pity about how he would never be loved. He basically had de facto won, let's say, three presidential elections. And despite doing that, he's, like, the loneliest man in the world because, like, he's undone by, like, his own self-destructive impulses, where if he had just trusted his intellect, trusted the professional sort of, like, the guiding instincts in him that drove him to be that far, trusted his instinct to come back again and again and again and to demonstrate resilience, like, the way he was, you know, like, everyone counted him out, like, coming out of Whittier. And then everyone counted him out when he was running for the Congress so young. Everyone counted him out when Ike wanted to kick him off the ticket when he was 39. Everyone counted him out after he lost the presidential election and then humiliatingly lost the governorship of California 2 years later. And yet he always came back. Everyone counted him out when he left the White House in disgrace and he ended up writing like 10 best-selling books and emerged as like a beloved elder statesman, improbably. You know, someone that even like Bill Clinton would call, like, telephone for advice on things like Russia and like and foreign policy generally. Like, he had this endless reservoir of, like, you know, stick-to-itiveness, I don't know what the word is, like, resilience to, like, keep coming back, and yet it was never enough. He was never loved. And, like, that's a great scene. It never happened. I'm sure he never looked at JFK's portrait and said that. But, like, the genius of Oliver Stone in that movie and the screenwriters is that, like, it's brief, it's narrowly tailored, and it encapsulates so many characteristics of the man that, like, I allow it, even though in so many other contexts it would not work, just like so much in this movie. But, like, they do such a masterful job painting a portrait of this guy. It works. It comes together. It's a great scene.
Yeah, it's interesting to think what Nixon might have been like had he maybe surrounded himself with not quite so morally decrepit people. Because, I mean, maybe a Nixon that didn't have Haldeman pouring poison in his ear might have, you know, not been so given into his impulses. There's this amazing scene near the end, and as we sort of wrap up here, I there's a couple other things I want to mention, because I sure. could go on way longer about this movie, but I don't want to, you know. But when he is, he's in the depths of his sort of alcoholism, and he's just sitting in his study listening to Victory at Sea records, and he's with Alexander Haig. And Alexander Haig brings in the bit about the Supreme Court is demanding to hear your tapes.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't get around that.
Yeah.
And he says something to, you know, he calls him Al, and he says something like, you know, hey, Al, is there anything do I have any other options? And Alexander Haig quietly says, you have the army.
Yeah.
And John Williams puts in this little ba-dum, like, drum beat bat, and it's terrifying. It's a terrifying moment because here you've got Alexander Haig basically saying, well, you could have a military takeover if you want. And it's absolutely terrifying. I mean, it's, you know, to be honest, I saw this movie in the theater when I was in my early 20s, and I've seen it many times since. And I used to think, wow, we got through that, and that'll never happen again. But, you know, it's amazing what you think. Maybe Nixon would have done better if he didn't have somebody like Alexander Haig there giving him that kind of advice. That's awful advice, Al. That's terrible advice.
That's terrible. Well, that's
you could ignore the Supreme Court. You know, like, no, you don't ignore the Supreme Court. You know, and so, you know, it's interesting. Maybe if he had had slightly better people, maybe Nixon would have come out better. But
I think Nixon
also was the one that hired them. So, you know.
Yeah, it's very telling that the same person – could surround himself with Pat Nixon and like H.R. Haldeman.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, for all of whatever personal ideological differences I have with like a Henry Kissinger, like, I can't deny how intelligent he is, and I can't deny how he like, he sort of understands that like you can't color outside of the lines. So like, you know, despite my disagreements with him, it is also telling that you could surround yourself with both Henry Kissinger and like Alexander Haig. You know, so it's again, that goes to the core of who he is. He was just like, he's sort of a walking contradiction.
Yeah, yeah. There's two other little details I just want to mention before I finish up here. And is that one is, there's a great moment where we see Nixon and Kennedy doing their debate, their famous debate. And we get a shot of inside the control room. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm getting confused. It's a later scene where Nixon is taking questions from people in the audience, and a black guy this black guy gets up, and he really gets up in Nixon's grill, and we cut to inside the control room, and the guy running the control booth is Michael Chiklis from the Shield, and he's asking Nixon this really hard question, and Haldeman is like, he's like, who is this Negro saying these Negro things, and he's so mad, and he says, cut to commercial. And Michael Chiklis says, there are no commercials. You got the whole hour, baby. And then I think it's Ron Ziegler, says, cut him off. And then Michael Chiklis says, cut him off. This isn't Russia. Oh, wow. Isn't that funny to think that back then that was a bad thing to maybe be aligned with Russia, you know?
I think exactly. Yeah, I love that scene. I love how panicky James Woods is about that act. And it's a great actor, a guy who would go on to star in Grey's Anatomy. I think James Pickens Jr. is his name, confronting Nixon about how divisive he is. But then in that same second, when things are getting heated, Anthony Hopkins pivots to that little girl holding that sign in the audience saying, bring us together, which is also based on something that happened in real life. And it just very deft, and it demonstrates how much he had grown since like the last time he was on television extensively for the Kennedy Nixon debates, which you alluded to mistakenly, but like those are worth discussing too, only because they really did a great job like showing the contrast between like, again, JFK's sort of windswept youth, and like, remember how much like Anthony Hopkins was like sweating like in those debates? It was so great, you know, like he was just so nervous. I mean, for all we can say about how little Anthony Hopkins actually looks like Richard Nixon or sounds like Richard Nixon, man, he nailed so many of like the nonverbals and the mannerisms, and like the sweat and the mumbling was so on point.
The very last thing that I want to mention about this movie is that I'm kind of a student of middle American political history. I've read a lot of books from sort of like the FDR period, Hoover, kind of up through Nixon. Those are the presidents I tend to really focus on. And one of the things I do is I watch this movie as part of an unofficial trilogy with 13 Days, which we actually covered on the show many episodes ago. And then I watch Path to War, which is about Lyndon Johnson.
Yep.
And this movie, and one of the things I like about it is because in real life you had a lot of the same people moving from administration to administration.
Yep.
You've got, you know, Robert McNamara is Secretary of Defense during 13 Days, and he's Secretary of Defense in Path to War. There are scenes in this movie where they talk about interacting with Lyndon Johnson, of course, because he says, we got advice from Lyndon. Bomb the shit out of him, boy.
And
of course, even though these movies were made with three different sets of people from three different studios, they also do feature in small roles a lot of the same actors. playing different parts. And I've noticed that, and I love that it gives you that sense of bizarro continuity that you're these actors. There's a brief moment for this actor named James Caron, who was one of my favorite character actors. You've seen him in Poltergeist and Return of the Living Dead, and he plays a Pentagon advisor, and he's trying to advise Nixon not to bomb Cambodia. And Nixon doesn't want to hear it. And Nixon says, we're going to make some noise. Or one people are going to take notice. And you hear James Caron mutter, they're going to take notice, all right. Because they think the guy's a madman. And
yep.
So when I watch Nixon, I tend to watch them collectively, all three movies together. Because it's just, there's something to me where you get a greater appreciation of that part of American history of watching Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon back to back to back. And
yeah,
I guess
facing a lot of very similar foreign policy crises, and it's like I'm not as familiar with Path to War. I'm assuming it's based on the Robert Caro book. I might be wrong. But I assume, especially with 13 Days, it's a really effective contrast to like in terms of the decision making process and sort of the values that color how they go into like formulating decisions, executing decisions, and how like highly or how little they regard the advice of the people around them and the quality of the people around them.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. They are all sort of just amazing portraits of the men in power and what they did with the power, and that to me is what is so fascinating. You see, and exactly, even like we mentioned, Edward Herman played FDR in a miniseries. You're seeing all these other people pop up that played presidents in other movies, and it just gives you that feeling of continuity. So until they make a great Gerald Ford movie. I can't.
Maybe it'll be around the agonizing decision over whether or not to pardon Nixon.
That's
maybe
a pretty big deal.
A 13-day style movie about that.
There you go. You know, so until they make however many days he served, 183 days as president, or whatever they make. But so it's. I think this is a masterful movie. It's not homework. I think it is. It is pulpy and dramatic and visually interesting filled to the walls with great performances. And for anybody, I think this would be an enjoyable movie for anybody that just likes a good drama, even if you aren't necessarily a student of history.
I agree. And I guess the last thing I would say on that to that point is, I hadn't watched it in a long time. I've probably seen this movie about 10 or 11 times, but I hadn't seen it in a good 3 or 4 years until I watched it a couple days ago. And as much as I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it for all the reasons that you pointed out, I was also filled up with a small but kind of inexplicable sense of sadness, because this is not a movie that would ever get made now.
No.
Like, there's no way in hell a major studio would greenlight a movie like this, or even greenlight a movie half this long with that cast. You know, like it's too bad, because I mean, it's sure there might be, lower budget movies with possibly lesser actors, but like I don't see a market for this. There was barely a market for this in 1995, so it's just kind of important to sort of go back and cherish it. I mean, I own it individually on DVD. I own it as part of like the Oliver Stone collection. I went and bought it on iTunes just because I wanted to contribute to it again somehow to its immediate box office ratings. I think it's a wonderful movie. I think it's a movie that doesn't really show its age. I think it's a movie that is one of the best of 1995. When I think of all the movies that were recognized as some of the best of that year, I think it deserves to be right up there with like Sense and Sensibility and Babe and like The Usual Suspects and everything. I think history has forgotten it, and I think that's too bad. And I think people should go back and look at it and view it, because it's A, it's really good, and B, you're not going to see anything like it ever, ever, ever again. No way could you assemble a cast that dynamic and that multifaceted. You could never assemble that deep a bench. You could never corral Oliver Stone these days to write something about a subject so sprawling and controversial in such a disciplined way and such a respectful, even-handed way. It's just all the elements came together at the right time, and too few people noticed it except the very best, like you and me.
There we go. We're going to leave it at that. I said I think that's a good way to end this. It's Nixon. So, Omar, thank you so much, man. I really enjoyed this, and I'm always so thrilled when there's a movie that I feel like I'm the only one that knows about it in some weird way, and then when I know someone else out there likes it as much as I do, it's always very rewarding. So thank you. I have to thank Ryan for hooking us up, and I have to thank you for coming on to talk about this. I mean, this was enormous fun.
It was my pleasure. It's a really wonderful movie. I really urge everyone to give it a shot. And I would echo what you said. It was really nice to be able to speak to someone else about like a really great film. So thanks for the opportunity.
All right. So, of course, everybody, if you want to find back episodes of the show, go to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and we can talk movies and stuff over on Twitter, which is at filmandwaterpod. So until next week, that's a wrap.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process, and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.